My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And I wish that all of you could sit up here at this head table and get the privilege of looking at 2,040 white eyeballs. This is an experience that is given to only a few. Those of you, as I noticed looking out here, have noticed the fashions in men have trended towards loud shirts, ties, and sport coats. Have you noticed that? I'm sure that must work a hardship on the girls. You can't tell who the pimps are anymore. The only one I'll vouch for is Dave C. I know he borrowed his shirt after he got down here. That's the fella that kind of looks like a spoiled cantaloupe. I, too, would love to compliment the committee on their selection of participants in this program that we've had, beginning Friday night, and Talbot told a lovely homespun story of Rickery. And this morning we heard another one, and this afternoon a beautiful Al-Anon story of spirituality. And now we come to the intellectual part of AA. I'm in the process of writing a 12th chapter to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it will be under title The Intellectual Approach to Alcoholism. Or, Who Furnishes the Entertainment Committee? But be that as it may, I think I'll take for the text of my sermon tonight a very brief phrase that appears in our big book. And this is the phrase, What Happened? Now, this is one of the most commonly used expressions in our society today. You can have an accident of any kind in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some cat will run up and say, What happened? Or as you're peacefully listening to television and you hear a bunch of dishes fall in the kitchen, What happened? It's one of the most common used expressions, I think, in our society today. Nothing new about it. Even in the scriptures, when the master healed the blind man, I think that somebody said, What happened? Do you remember? His retort was, All I know is once I couldn't see and now I can. And I think that some of us who come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and are not familiar with all the mechanics of spirituality can only give the simple expression, All I know, once I was drunk and now I'm sober. So, let's talk a little about what happened. What happened? This seems to be a rather competitive event. Everybody that's talked at this convention has told how hard luck always befell them, or how they ran into hard times and each one came on with a more tear-jerking story than the last. And I think I could quickly tell you that I had some pretty bad luck, too. We moved to a strange town to get away from it all, and I got run over by the welcome wagon. So let's stop this boasting about hard times. I drank innocently enough with my first one. Took it when I was age 17 to be a part of a group of young fellas. Nobody twisted my arm or poured it down me. But I drank that night for a psychological reason. I'll throw these words in as I go along. Remember, I promised to be intellectual tonight. But I wanted to be accepted in this group, and this was the only way I could achieve it. And they fed me a vile green fluid that down in East Texas they call home brew, which I think was really bragging on it. And I got drunk this night, and very drunk. But I found something in that drink that night that the other guys didn't find. And I returned to it again and again. Now, those fellas that drank with me that night when I was age 17 are still around. Some of them are my friends, and some of them remain in the realm of social drinkers. Do you know any social drinkers? I have a very humble opinion about social drinking, and that is that if you take the most pious and unctuous old sister out of the church and slap about 8 slugs of that gallo in her that I used to drink, she's going to become unsocial as hell. But incidentally, there's only 2 kinds of people in AA, and that's the yeah buts and I know. You pick them out for yourself. You ever try to tell a fella about his problem and you get real heated up about it and he says, yeah, but my problem's different. Or I know. So you can compare yourself to the graveyard, if you look around. But I went to it because it did something for me. I began it, and I knew that it made me a very, very brilliant man when I did. It removed all of my inhibitions. I became profound and felt that I was a part of the world. As long as the heat of this alcohol was working in here. It was an answer. And I put it to good use. Wasn't compulsive at all. I used it. But one day it became that way. There came a day, after using it for so long a time, then it failed to perform its duty. Now, this is the hellish part of our disease, is when you drink it to obtain a certain degree of satisfaction and nothing happens. One of the most common complaints that I hear in the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous is the ability to hit the happy medium. Have you ever heard guys come in and talk about that? They want to get to a certain point of this beautiful exhilaration and then stop. I used to shoot at that thing forever, you know. I'd get right up to it and down. And there's only one exception to that rule. I used to drink with a group of intellectuals in a bar across the street from the state capitol in Sacramento. It was a rather polyglot aggregation of people. We had a couple of news writers there. And I had an old gal that drank with us who was sleeping with a part in Tilford salesman. And this was purely platonic, of course. She'd steal his samples and bring them to us, and we'd drink and talk, you know. And also in this group, there was a, and I use this, I'm not critical, was a cross-eyed fortune teller who had a little place across the street from this bar. And she looked like a fortune teller should. She had the voluminous gown and the black thing on her head, and she told a wicked fortune and was a very, very proficient shoplifter, which made it handy for us. But one morning, I had mooched a jug of gin way up the street where they didn't know me, and I brought it back to my bar and set it down and had engaged the bartender in conversation. And I realized something happened over here, but I was too busy talking that I didn't pay any attention until a little later, and I discovered that my jug of gin was gone. And I immediately suspected this fortune teller. And she had gone out the back door with it, and I immediately took up pursuit. And we went across this street with a lot of traffic, and she went through this black curtain, and I went behind her. And she ran in there and tried to get a drink before I could get to her. And then she's always grinning. That cross eyes made it worse than ever. And this was the only time that I ever struck a happy medium. Take my word for it, you can't do it. If you're compulsed to drink, there's no happy medium at all. You can't satisfy an insatiable desire like I had. And I found myself in Southern California among the group in Hollywood. A young East Texas lad, and I was studying under one of the more eminent designers of ladies' lingerie. This is where you cut those soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that women wear. Rather pleasant profession. If any of you gals got a pinch, why, I quit a long time ago. Don't blame it on me. We've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous that seems to be a stumbling block for some of these cats that they come dragging in, and that's the second one, where it infers that you might have a gopher in the garden there somewhere. Something about your head, you know. A drunk hates me to talk about his brain at all, and this one really puts it to you. And I'd like to say to you, my friends, if you cut a bunch of brassieres with three of those places in them, you're nuts. And I told a psychiatrist about that, and he said it was just wishful thinking. But You know the story. I cut myself completely out of that profession. Just cut myself out of it. And I was working for a very kind and compassionate Jewish fellow who had invested a lot in my education. And he hated to have to tell me that he'd had all he could stand. And he came to me and told me, one of the first people that ever brought me face to face with myself. And he said, "Joe, you can't drink like that." And you know I proceeded to show him that I could. And he said, "You're going to have to leave." He said, "With all we've got invested with you, we can't afford you anymore." And then in an aside, he said, "We've got one thing to be thankful about." He said, "I'm certainly happy that you weren't a rabbi, because the way you use those scissors, if you had been, you'd have destroyed our whole race." At that time, and I went down to the shipyard in San Pedro, and I literally bought a plumber's license out the back door of a union hall. This is a guy that's never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors. And you know that I went into there as a master fraud, like most of us drunks do. And this is the beginning of the perpetual lie. We got to lie. Did you ever hear of a drunk that could ever get his second job if he told about the first one? This becomes a part of our natural makeup, the lie. So I go into the shipyard, and these were those days when, it's revolting to think about, but you were frozen to your job. Do you remember that? Well, I thawed out. I have a little pink piece of paper that hangs in my den today as a memento. I keep it as a souvenir, and it's signed by the United States Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. How lucky can you get? Then you say, the drunk does, to his wife, "I can't even look for a job. You better go get one." Say, "Ah, we're great executives, us drunks." So Mary was gainfully employed, and we made it for a little. Then began the process of moving. Anybody ever say, "Honey, they don't appreciate us here. Let us go somewhere and start over"? We always managed to start under, but we was trying to start over. But I moved up into Northern California, and the choice of things to do for a brilliant fellow like me was getting fewer and fewer, and I was forced to go to work. That "forced" not a good word. For the railroad. Now, I'd like to say here that they're a group of the most narrow-minded people I've ever met. They have a rule about drinking, and it reads that if you're seen coming out of a place that even dispenses alcoholic beverages, you can be fired. I never came out very often. It's a good thing that you don't have to guide trains. It's a real good thing. And I stayed sober for a little while through brute force and awkwardness to prove to these people what a genius they had been fortunate enough to hire. And then I did what my wife used to say. I know none of you ever heard this. I got with the boys again. Why the hell do they always want to blame it on somebody else? The boys didn't want to have much to do with me, really. But this reflex that the Al-Anon has to cover him up, make excuses for him, we went through many years of that. One old sister in the neighborhood said to my wife, this is my wife, said, "Why do you live with a man like that?" And in her loving reflex, she said, "Why, you don't know him when he's sober." And this old lady said, "When is he sober?" Making excuses one for another. Well, the railroad made a bad mistake. They had a piece of track up on top of the Sierra Nevada mountains that they had just installed a beautiful and very expensive, I'm sure, electronic set of equipment called an interlocking system, and had spent untold thousands of dollars to perfect it. And they made the mistake of hanging a bulletin out in the open where everybody could see it that said, in essence, it's physically impossible to make a mistake up there. They shouldn't have done that. Physically impossible to make a mistake up there. They didn't know about alcoholism like you and I do, did they? And that's just exactly what I did. By some quirk of alcoholic manipulation, I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them, carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery, and made the biggest goddamn fruit salad in history. And they narrow-minded people wanted to fire them. And they gave me some days about it. And I remember this old superintendent, bless his heart, he was a very compassionate man, and he was so determined that he's going to fire me. And I had another alcoholic representing me at the investigation. And he proved some of the most atrocious lies that you can imagine. And I got out of it. And the old man said, I said you ought to be arrested for even walking on our right-of-way. And I'll get you yet, he said. You know, he never got the privilege of firing me. I just wandered off into limbo and never came back. A drunk will discharge himself. I have been asked to tell this story, and I will, and this is the one about the guy that comes home and can't hide his jug from the little woman. This seems to be one of the more popular cries that they talk about when they are first sober. Well, I'll tell you a little story about hiding a jug. One night I got called off of, maybe you'll understand some of this parlance, this vernacular of the railroad. I got called off of the extra board to go up to a place, Marysville, California, on a fruit train. And they called to my crew, a group of fellas just like me, I had to help the engineer to get up on the engine so we could go. And we got up there, and we did some work through brute force and awkwardness. I fell over a few switches, but we did something, really. And along about 10 o'clock, to my delight, I discovered a big packing shed that had a track running in it. And I took my train and started chopping it up into little pieces so it would have no resemblance of being a train, a car here, two there, three here. And I took the engine and the caboose and put them in this shed and locked the door. And we went to the bar. And the war was going on, and the dispatcher was perturbed. Trains going every direction, up and down, but no word from us. And you're supposed to run over some little gadgets on the track that makes a beep go off in his ear. He hadn't had any beeps at all. And this goes on, and he called up and down the line by telephone. Nobody had seen it. So they sent an official in an automobile up to look for us, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, he walked into the bar and found us. And you know what his words were to me? What did you do with it? And the guy couldn't hide a joke. Couldn't hide a joke. Well, I don't think I've ever met an alcoholic who didn't have a deep appreciation of the ridiculous. This seems to be the other side of our personality. And when I hear a drunk sit out there and laugh, it does me twice as much good as it does anybody else, because we've cried enough. And for every laugh we get, we're entitled to it, believe you me. We started going through these years of making excuses for a hellish thing that we didn't even know existed. Oh, you've heard them. Time on end, the wife to come up and say, he'll do better. He'll do better. Or let's start over again. I've been subjected to every cliche that society knows about in my drinking. They used to say to me, straighten out and be a man. And I did, just like that. Or, haven't you learned your lesson? You ever heard that? And then here was a good one they used to say, none of you ever heard this, I know, say, turn over a new leaf. I'd like to say here that the only guy I ever heard of had any luck turning over these leaves was this Adam chap you read about in the Bible. I didn't. So you see, we make excuses when you don't even ask us to. This is the true sign of an alcoholic, when he comes up and says and starts telling you why he drinks, when you don't even ask him. I remember one day I was in Roseville, California, and I'd been in the bar all day. Awake and asleep. The bar, delightful place, had sleeping facilities. And at 4 in the afternoon, maybe, I got up and staggered out in that state that some of you may be familiar with, of neither drunk nor sober. State of complete saturation. And I wandered down the street home. I say home. We were living with my wife's sister, And this was a beautiful relation. And I remember I walked into the bedroom there and lay down upon the bed, and my wife and her sister was in the next room, and they thought I was asleep. And they should have. I always had been. And my wife in hysteria cried out to her sister and said, "Oh my God," said, "what would you do if you were living with a man like that?" And her sister didn't hesitate a moment. She said, "I'd poison the son of a bitch." Let me tell you something. From then on, they ate first. Have any of you ever felt that small? This is the insidious affliction of alcoholism. This is the indescribable thing down deep that we can't explain. And we learn to practice the proficient art of self-pity. Oh, woe is me. Why do these things happen to such a charming fellow like me? This is the question that's never answered. Well, I ain't got time, but I'm going to tell this story. Tony asked me to. And this is as good a place to tell it as I know. And I think it highly depicts the ability of the alcoholic to orient himself to any condition. Ike Sheridan used to say that when you start smelling yourself, other people have been smelling you 3 days. But I was in a little town called Goose Creek, Texas. Some of you may know where it is. And selling insurance to those prostitutes over on the road there at the Humble Camp in Baytown, Texas. And I had a pretty good thing going there, but I drank it up. And Mary went off up into Illinois as her sister was going to have a baby, and Mary figured she'd need a little help. And while Mary was gone, I got fired. And I had to load all of our stuff up, which was very little. And I put it in the back of an old 31 Chevrolet. And we had two cats. Mary and I have always had cats. And these were two tomcats, and I knew that I dare not come home without them. So I loaded the two cats in the back of the Chevrolet and started to Tyler. And as I approached the city limits of Houston, I saw a beautiful sign, and it said, 3 pints for the price of 2. And never being one to let a bargain get away, I bought 3 pints. And I started up, and as I remember, it was a cold, damp, rainy night. And the old windows were frosted up. It is chilly to be pleasant. And I drank and drove and talked to myself and sang a little bit. You know how that feeling of deep satisfaction that you can get like that. And I stopped up in a little town. If I remember, this was Cleveland, Texas. I don't know where the hell it is. But I went in to get a chaser, and I came out, and one of the damn tomcats got out of the car, you see. And I chased him all over town. I knew I dare not come home without him. And I finally treed him up under a cotton gin down there. All this red mud, and I caught him, and I whipped him all the way back to this car. And threw him inside this hot automobile, and he did a thing in that back seat that ain't nice. And I crawled in and took off and drank some more. Didn't bother me really too much. And about 3 a.m, I threw up in the front seat. Never noticed it much. Sang a little. And as it was breaking day, I drove into a little town called Aldo, Texas, one long main street. There's one, two dim street lights there, and I pulled over to the side in order to uncap the bottle. And there was a town clown there, door rattler, a constable of sorts, and I guess it was the first opportunity he'd had to make an arrest in many years. And he came up. He came up and knocked on that door glass and said, let that glass down. And I said, and I let the glass down, and he said, what do you think you're... And he slowly walked away. When you put the arm of love around a poor, sick old drunk that comes into AA, my friends, he don't know how he feels. And with all of the great buildings and all of the professionalism, with all of the intellectuality and all of the progress that we've made, there is nothing that will substitute for an hour of your time. There ain't much else you can give. And you're looking at a guy that's sober because a guy had an hour. No, I'm not qualified for talk, intellectuality. The only thing I know about AA is what it says on page 28. Is that until you arrive at an understanding, little or nothing can be done. Ain't that right? Well, I see by the clock it's too early for me to get well. The physical end of alcoholism set the trap for me. I got down, I got on wine quite by accident. That sounds good. Now, notice that if you read your program closely, that they had that on there, wine. Oh, that cuts me to the quick. I'll have to go through life with a cut quick, I guess. But... And I remember my first drink of wine, how ashamed I was. In California, in those days, there wasn't any facilities for alcoholics. We didn't hear anything about alcoholism. I had heard the word wino, believe you me. And I went into a bar one morning and couldn't take anything. What is this high-sounding word? Regurgitate? I went in to a little Irish bartender that I had befriended in my hotel, and I said to him, Curly, I can't take my breakfast this morning. And I remember how benevolently he answered. Weren't those fellas sweet? I think that all bartenders should have been psychiatrists. I don't know what the hell I think psychiatrists ought to be in, But he was so kind and compassionate, and he'd listen to my stories and listen to me talk. And I knew that he knew what a genius I was beneath it all. And he said, Joe, said, there's a bottle of wine over behind the counter there. He was out in front. He said, if you'll take a drink of that, then you can go back to whiskey. And I'd like to say here that I never did go back to whiskey. I like what that stuff does to you. There's a little something peculiar about the effects of wine. I don't know what it is, but you can puke in Technicolor. They're a different breed, believe you me, I'll tell you. And you talk about reading in the scripture, sister, about the vain babble and the unknown tongue. Them winos have got a patent on it. But with the first drink of it, I was ashamed, more so than usual. I didn't want anybody to call me a wino, and as I was running back and forth from Sacramento into Reno, I'd go to the far end of the street in order that nobody would see me, and I'd go down where there's only the bartender and then go in and drink. But I had it. And I got down, DTs and all those other little accoutrements that go along with our disease. And it's not possible for me to describe this to you. You got to go before you'll know. It's kind of like Maddie's ballroom. If you don't go, you don't know what goes on down there. And the same thing with DTs and hallucinations. But I got up out of this hotel and staggered to our apartment in downtown Sacramento. And I remember that I cried out to Mary and I said, I believe I'm sick. Now, I never had been sick before. Except this irping sick that you've heard them talk about here at this convention. And I thought everybody threw up every morning. It is the way of life with me. I used to rent a hotel room with twin beds in it, one to sleep in, one to throw up in. But I think that my wife detected that something hellish had happened to me. We didn't have any family physician, and we didn't want to call the railroad. You know, I told you about that rule that they had. But we were finally forced to call a little railroad physician, and he came down there, unsuspecting little booking GP, and here's the wives. He said to Mary, "Does he drink?" "Uh-uh," she said. "Why will they lie about it?" And then he knew better, I'm sure, and he gave me a shot of the happy medicine in the arm and gave me a prescription for some of the most delightful pills that I later acquired a taste for. 1 grain phenobarbital tablets. And he said to my wife, "This man is sick and he needs to be in the hospital." And they trundled an ambulance up to the door. Oh, hell, it was a dramatic scene. And Mary followed the body out. And we went to San Francisco with the red light on and the siren screaming, making 90 miles an hour, and I'm up in the back eating them pills. And I've always looked back on this trip with a feeling of irony. Here's a guy that's been drunk 18 years and they're in a hurry to do something about it. Ain't that the way the non-alcoholics treat us? Right now. You know, when I got to the hospital, it was a day and a half before I saw a doctor. I guess they were out testing cigarettes or breaking the laxative habit or something. I don't know. And they put me through one of the most stringent clinics on the West Coast, from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. And the only thing I got out of it was the knowledge that you shouldn't go to a proctologist with a hangover. Whew, you... Hey. And the result of this trip through the clinic was that I had nothing organically wrong with me. And the hospital works on a different theory. They say we've got to have something wrong with him. And this was my introduction to psychiatry. And I'd like to make an humble observation to you drunks that of all the alcoholics in AA that I know, that have had their alcoholism beaten out of them through their knees are very few. But they brought in this frustrated piano tuner. And he beat my knees and asked me questions, very dumb questions, and I'd give him brilliant answers. If he's not a rummy now, it's not my fault. I remember one question he asked me. He said, "Did you ever suck your thumb?" And I remember how he quivered when I told him. I said, "I still do." I doubt it. Yeah. I gave him a very graphic description of how I'd run off over in the corner and take a quick pull at it. You know? Well, we counted blocks and sorted string, and I became rather adept at finger painting. Now, you folks look like you're a good, forthright and unprocrastinating group of people, and I'm going to tell you how to get rid of a psychiatrist if the occasion ever arises. You let two drunks lay up in bed one night and memorize the same dream to tell him the next morning. They will leave you alone. Well, he prescribed another delightful little dose that some of our girlfriends in AA are quite fond of, and that's bromide. You know, the sodium bromide elixir is the granddaddy of nerving. You've heard the folks say, Aunt Minnie can't come out today, she's nervous. She can't come out today, she's stoned. But he prescribed this dose for me, 5 little shot glasses a day. He said to calm me down. And with my reasoning, I thought if 5 little shot glasses would calm me down, a jug would be lots better. And I bought it from an intern. I was getting a lot of therapy, wasn't I? Was getting phenobarbital, sodium bromide elixir, and I had a Mexican and was running through the elevator shaft for wine. Great treatment. And he came to my nervous ward one morning, and he said, you can go home now. I don't know what made him decide this. I guess it was, when I got there, I was down, and now I was partly up, and this made the great difference. I had run the gamut from nervous anxiety to schizophrenia and back, and they pronounced me as an ambulatory schizophrenic. Now, if you don't know what that is, that's a going Jesse with dual wheels. So I go home. They gave me a jug of bromide and 125 phenobarbital tablets and headed me in the direction of Sacramento. And the trip that I'd come down so hurriedly took me 4 days to get back. My wife set great store by this trip to the hospital. She thought that it was going to be an answer to our problem. And I remember how happy she was when I came home. And I had my cake and I could eat it. Had a disease. And I could tell about it in the bar. Did you ever walk up to an old drunk sitting on a bar stool and punch him in the back and ask him a question right quick? You know what he'll say to you? I've been sick. Won't he? Why, it's the greatest satisfaction to our self-pity that one can imagine. And one day the roof fell in on me. This bartender called my wife on the phone and he said, Mrs. Leith, you think your husband's sick. He said, when you go to work, he comes down here. Then he runs home at 11:30 and gets in bed and lets you come home and fix his noon meal. And then when you go back to work, he gets up and comes back down here again. And he added another line. He said, we don't want him. And this was quite a blow to Mary. Quite a blow indeed. And she was perturbed and she picked up the phone and called this skull jockey or psychiatrist down in San Francisco. And I don't know what he told her, but this was when she left. And I say that without any rancor in my heart whatsoever. Because if you drank like I did, and alcohol was your crutch, You'd use any crutch at hand to perpetuate this thing. And the absence of my wife was only the absence of another crutch. I had a few left. And I think that some of us old last gaspers that came to AA when we did had to run out of all the alternatives. A lot of guys don't have to come now. They can fall off of the sofa a couple of times and their wife fuss at them. But they don't have to get here. But some of us had to. This was the last call. We had completely run out of alternatives. And I ended up back in Tyler, Texas. The hospital had shipped me down there and found a little hometown psychiatrist. He was a lonely little fellow. And he loved to talk. And I'd let him lay there and talk, and he'd give me goofballs by the popcorn sack full. And I thought I was bedded down for the winter, really. And I woke up one morning and staring at two deputy sheriffs. And they said, "Let's go," and I did. Now I remember in this county pokey in my hometown how I felt. And I suppose that I exercised every shortcoming that's described in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the biggest of which was hate. And now I said to myself, "Oh, they've brought this great humiliation down upon me. Hell, it wasn't my first jail, nor was it my last." But I remember the boiling, seething hate that was in me for everybody concerned. And I'd been there about 5 days, I guess. I don't know, long enough for these pellets to die out in me. My eyes had kind of come uncrossed. And there was a fellow came to my boudoir with the vertical Venetian blinds. And he asked for me by name. I'd never seen him before. And he stood outside those bars and gave me what we've come to know as the AA pitch. And he talked exclusively about himself. He didn't talk about me. If he had, I could have given him all the answers. And I remember this moment, the demeanor of that man, how he evidenced serenity. He wasn't in any hurry. And he told me all about himself. Sometimes I grow weary. And sitting around a group of us fattened up drunks, and we hear a guy say, "If he wants it, let him come get it." And if I can remember the words verbatim of our two co-founders, Bill and Bob, that after they found that this miracle would work, this is what they said: "Let us go out and find another drunk." And you are looking at a man who is alive today because a guy had an hour to spend with me. Now, tell in a book. Not intellectual. It's not profound. What happened? Well, I know how it hurt me. I know how little I felt to gain. I didn't accept his message. And I asked him more than once, "Who sent you to see me? This is who I particularly wanted to hate." I went to see an old boy over in East Texas not too long ago, and he's laying on that bed and that bloodshot eyes and rolled up in that sheet like a pencil. And he looked up at me and said, "Who turned me into that outfit?" And I know just how he felt. We get up for day after day after day and talk about suffering and how we rise above it. I don't remember any of the physical suffering. The doctors tell you that if you could, you'd still be in it. But let me tell you what I remember. I remember the humiliations and the indignities that befell me. And I didn't have the answer to say why it was happening. Don't tell me that's not suffering. This is in extremis. Good Latin, isn't it? Well, I didn't follow him. Wasn't ready. There's a word for you. Back off and let him die. That's what they say nowadays. He ain't ready. I've been a pallbearer in the last 8 years at 17 funerals when they wasn't ready. Some of it could have been me. Maybe I wasn't ready to cope with the situation, nor was I grateful enough to stay and talk. Well, I went back to California. Bob, they carried me down to Houston. Two sheriffs did. My people hired them too. This has been the treatment for alcoholism up until the advent of our society. Keep him moving. Keep him moving. Hadn't it? It's been the treatment for us drunks. No family likes to admit that they've got one of us, and my family sure as hell had one. And these two burly fuzzies drove me to Houston, put me up on a train late one night, even helped me find a seat. It's not a quick way to make friends on a train. And they carried me off of that train in a wheelchair in Los Angeles with three old dirty bags. Some smart aleck said, "You can't live in this car. It goes back and forth." I'd kind of set up shop in one of the toilets there. And I remember this, riding out in that wheelchair and getting dumped in the front foyer of the old Southern Pacific Depot in Los Angeles. And with all the jocular remarks that I might make, with all the levity and all the fun that we had, and laughing at the ridiculous antics of a poor drunk, I can say to you that the next 5 months were a living hell, and I drank as few people ever have and lived to tell the tale. And I ended up under the bridge in Sacramento, and those of you who were familiar with that particular scene in those days know that the odds were against you. If you ever got in, you'd never get out. This guy that called on me in jail that day, as he slowly left, very unconcerned, he wrote his name on the back of a little pamphlet that had been printed in this area down in the south back there, and the title of which was "Slaves of Drink Find Peace of Mind." One of the members of this very group was instrumental in creating this piece of literature. Thank God. And every night in this flop house, when I'd open up one of these bags, it seemed like the shell game, this damn pamphlet was on top. And I never read it. Didn't have the courage, but I saw the cover. "Slaves of Drink Find Peace of Mind." And by brute force and awkwardness, and you know the shaking and puking that goes on in a series like that, I got up out of that place and started to look for the guy that gave it to me. And I made a 2,600-mile trek back to Tyler, Texas, in search of this guy. You know, a drunk's got to be very dramatic and do everything in the big way. I later found out that there was an AA club three blocks from this flop house that I left. This time, my case was different. It was different. And I looked for this fellow. When I got back to Tyler, my people wanted to have me locked up again. They believe that this iron is a great cure for our disease. And I'm not so sure that it don't help a little myself. I think that St. Paul was very effective in his writing. They kept him locked up for a long time there. In jail, the beautiful thing about it is that you can think unmolested. And if you have a problem to work on, you know, thinking-wise, if you work on it all day and don't quite finish it, you can work on it tomorrow. Jail's not so bad, really. And I have also in my den at home one of the greatest things on earth, and I prize it very highly, and that is the key to the third floor of our old jail. One of the commissioners came over into my office not so long ago and had the whole chain. He said, "Joe, we're going to tear down the old jail, and we felt like you might want one of these." He was kind of tongue-in-cheek, this fellow was. He's kind of ashamed, but I think Mary put him up to it. And he came over there, and this big old wide wire chain, and he said, "Is there one of these you'd like to have?" And I said, "Yeah, that one right there." And I've got it at home. You talk about the key to love and understanding. This is it. So I call the guy, make this great dramatic gesture, and I tell him, "Well, I'd like to go back and see what you got down there." And his demeanor was the same. He was the same peaceful guy, and he said, "Are you sure that you want to quit drinking?" And I said, "Yes, I believe I am." And he took me to my first AA meeting. And I've had to compare all other AA meetings by that one. It shoved me up these old dirty stairs. Why are all of them upstairs? And they were kind of cut on the bias, and it was a kind of a cloak and dagger thing. We went up, and we got up there, and I don't remember any of the things that were said that night, any of the profound statements that the old elder statesman dropped. You know what I remember about that first AA meeting? I experienced a communication with you. And I said to myself subconsciously, I guess, that here are some people just like me. And I thought I was an only one. I thought I was a raravis, a bird of a different description. That none other like me ever existed, nor ever had fallen to the toils of what I had. Here are some people just like me. And the sickening loneliness that befalls every drunk as long as he sits on a bar stool and drinks left me that night, and thank God it has never returned. And I think that in our society, that if there is a responsibility, if we do acquire one, it's what we show that poor old drunk the first night he comes. By God, that's the responsibility that I am. Well, I don't know about what you found in AA, but this night, sometime during the meeting, there was an old sheriff who had locked me up in his jail some 12 years prior to this time. And here he was in AA, sober 2 years then, still had his pistols on. And he gave me, I think, the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. He put his arm around me and he said to me, "I love you, boy," this rough old sheriff. And he said, "You can stay sober like I do." How about that? Rarely ever seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our plan. I think you can stay sober like I do. And to him I will always be indebted. And I think that if we ever took anything for a symbol in AA that would replace the praying hands, it would be the crooked arm. Friend, if you've never had it in that shape around an old drunk, you're in for a new experience. And if you want to learn something about the mechanics of God's handiwork, get a new one. Take him off in the corner and put the arm in the proper position and say to him, "What happened?" And let him tell you, because I can't. "Oh, I got well in a hurry. Learned it all in a few weeks. All you had to do was ask me. I just went out of myself there. I read all the literature by Emmett Ginsberg and E. Stanley Hootenanny and the Blue Book and the Pink Book, and I became so, really godlike, if you please." You ever seen any AA members who are godlike? One night I got a call to get a drunk out of a bar. And I remember how good I felt on my way down there to save this poor bum. And I got a friend of mine to go with me, and we put him in our new automobile. All he wanted was for us to get him out of the bar safely. But I couldn't see that. I was so godlike. And we put him between us, and I drove slowly and talked to him with sheer eloquence. And as we drove down, his eyes began to water, and I thought to myself, "You're getting him, Joe." And as we drove on and I talked with further piousity and eloquence, he gently laid his head over on my shoulder. And I knew I had it. Did you ever hear of anybody throwing up silently? Every time I've ever gotten godlike with a drunk, he pukes on me. What is our heritage in this society of service? We give lip service to it. How long do you work with a drunk? Nobody's ever answered the question. Where's the stopping place in our society? I don't know. I worked with a drunk one time for 4.5 years. He called Mary one day, and that is when we took all the calls. We didn't deal them out to some new man. And she said, "Yes, Joe will come see you." And I went. Found this old boy, and he was just about as scurvy as I am. And I borrowed a goblet full of whiskey and poured it down him. He was verging on DTs. And I knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshackled from this drink, he was in an AA club. So I believe any way you can get him there is good. And he got sober under my guidance. And he stayed sober for 3 months, and then he got drunk. And this was a great blow to my ego. I knew this guy had to get sober. And I went and got him again. And I brought him back to AA. And got him sober again. And he stayed sober for 3 months and he got drunk. And he had another little affliction that I know none of you have ever had. He'd go to far away places and call me Colette. Just to tell me that he was drunk. And I prayed about him. I did everything. I said, God, you've been watching them sparrows too much to let me have this one. I'll tell you. And he kind of became a side project with me. But I never gave up. Kept working. See his wife more than I did him, but he's out. Go get him, sober him up, drunk again. And about 7 years ago, he got on for him what I hope was his last drunk. In one of our local motels. And he called another fella from our group who's not half as smart as I am. And he talked to that bastard for 10 minutes, and he's been sober ever since. I hated his guts. I'd sit in the club and look at him and say, you ought to be mine. And if I know anything about the treasure of love that God gives us, I owe him more than he owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. I would have to leave the explanation of God's handiwork to my betters. I can't tell you the treasure that there is in AA. I'm not capable of that. I could tell you a little story that comes from their book, maybe in closing, about the story of a call made on a sick guy. Fella went to see a sick guy. The only difference in this trip and going to see the sick guy was that it happened 2,000 years ago. This is the story of a fella in the scripture that they called a demoniac. For the lack of better verbiage, in those days they said he was a maniac full of demons. Kind of like me. If he'd have been today and they could have psychoanalyzed him, he would have been a catatonic or a bedwetter or something or other. But those days, he was a demoniac for the lack of better education. And it says that in the scripture that he was so wild that no man could tame him, didn't it? And that the manifestations of his disease, now, remember this, it didn't say that he was a sinner and needed saving. The manifestations of his disease were such that they kept him in fetters and chains. Kind of like me. And he got so bad, this demoniac, that they ran him out of town. Just like me. And he ended up out on the riverbank And if you've got the imagination that I have, you can see it. The babble, the dirty clothes, the sickened mind, the perfect scene of one of us. And there seems to be, or there seemed to be at that time, there was a little carpenter fellow who was going around teaching a new philosophy of love. And this fellow had a trick there that none of us have quite acquired. He could see no ill in anyone. Roll that one around your head for a while. He could see no ill in anyone. Saw the poor sick guys here, and the little carpenter knew that he needed some help, and by some very, very unusual circumstances, he was healed. And the people of that day didn't understand this healing any more than some of the people today understand ours. And there is a line in our book of experience that says that there is a thing that will forever keep man in eternal ignorance, and that is condemnation before investigation. These people didn't take time to investigate either. They knew that some of their pigs had been lost, and they were in the pig business. And they were more concerned about that than they were this one fella getting well. This didn't bother them at all. By God, in AA, one feller getting well better mean something to you, let me tell you. So, the scripture says that they came out in mass. And these are the words that are beautiful. Said when they got there, there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. We got a step like that, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, haven't we? There he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. I can see him, timid, afraid, not knowing what was going to befall him, having left one life and not experiencing the beauty of another yet. And he had to depend upon the power from which it came. And these people were trying to get him to run off, and I can see the little fellow. And he said to the carpenter, "Friend, how about letting me go with you?" And the little carpenter broke a rule. Everybody that he had ever helped before and after this, he'd always told them, said, don't say anything about this to anybody. Just go on, don't say anything about it. Accept it like we give it. But he broke a rule here. And he said something to this sick guy that I'm going to say to you. Stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you.